the thing that I'm building towards this next feat is like the scariest shit I've ever done, but it's still like the biggest dream I ever had. And so I'm going to go through it 100%. And people are like, oh, but you've got kids. And like certain people that are in my wheelhouse are like, not want to support my dream because they're like, you've got too much to lose. I'm like, that's not your decision to make. It's mine. And I want to be the example to my kids. And I feel confident that I can navigate these waters and do it successfully.
Welcome back to the Riders Lounge podcast. I'm your host for the slowest, but hopefully not the most boring form of content around freestyle motocross. I'm Steve Sommerfeld, and today we've got one of the biggest names in action sports joining us. It is Robbie Madison, who actually blew my mind at the end of this interview, and you'll find out why. The reason I did want to catch up with Maddo this time wasn't so much to talk about what he's doing, but rather what it feels like for him to be the one looking on and watching his own son with Cruz Madison making his debut in his first ever freestyle motocross show at the Freestyle Kings event in Gosford just last weekend. Even only at the very young age of 11 years old, Cruz already sounds like he's years beyond his age. And to be riding in front of thousands of cheering fans while sending his KTM 65 over 45 feet, he must have had to hold his nerve just to get the job done and jump with what was in front of him. And I wonder what it felt like for Maddo as a dad watching on as his son looks to be starting his own career in one of the most dangerous of all action sports in the world. I think everyone would have their own opinions and also your own reactions if you were in that position. But from the sounds of it, both Robbie and Cruz have well and truly got their heads screwed on. And I think Mum probably keeps an even closer eye over the both of them. But fairly quickly, actually, while the Madisons were on the road, Cruz even joined us on this interview, so we did get to hear from the kid himself exactly what it was like to ride at that Freestyle Kings show. And while the spotlight wasn't really on Maddo this time, man, there were some awesome insights into the world of movie stunts, like when he's performing as James Bond 007, or his own New Year's Eve stunts in the past, and he's got something huge that he's been planning for a long time. Something that I've been planning for a long time is I'll be going in for my total hip replacement surgery tomorrow morning, but I won't need to worry about missing out on a cold beer while I'm recovering and in rehab, as I'll have to try and pack a box of Rorthaus, Tannen and Zapfler alcohol-free beers into the van. Hopefully I can smuggle them into the hospital on my 5-day stay as I learn to walk with my new bionic hip joint. So yeah, after every surgery, I always stop drinking to give my body the best chance at healing, and I'm just stoked that the Tannen and Zapfler tastes like the real deal, and it won't be slowing down my recovery. Right, now, I do have to fill out my last surgery documents now. I've got to go to bed early because 3 a.m. I have to drive to the hospital. So sit back, relax, and I hope you enjoy listening to this one with one of the all-time greats in action sports, Robbie Madison.
Mate, right now I'm sitting in Jaipur, India. It's one of the hottest places on earth at times. Right now we're blessed with it. It's not super hot, but tomorrow we start filming. I'm doing a content piece out here with Red Bull India. I'm delivering the Rajasthan Royals cricket team their 2022 jerseys. I've been to India quite a bit the last couple of years. I've done about this, I think this is my fifth trip here. Three of the trips have been to ride motorcycles. I did two independent trips to do recces, like kind of reconnaissance missions to try and figure out filming concepts and ideas. And finally, we've got this project to kind of come to life. So, I'm in Jaipur in India. It's, you know, we're kind of a little bit south of Delhi, New Delhi, and we're right in the middle of the country. So it's a different place, man. It's, you know,
yeah,
all the family with me this time. You know, I'm hoping the kids get to literally see a third world country in poverty, and I'm hoping that has a positive, lasting, you know, impression on them. But yeah, we're out here and just doing, I'm kind of having like a little, I've been kind of doing like 15, 20 hour days the last couple of days, just getting everything set up. And today we kind of just went and did a shakedown on the bike. I had a ride this morning. We shot some content. I rode at this place called Valley Off Wheels. And it's here in Jaipur. It's a motorcycle. It's a private park for motorcycles by a Gurav. I'm not sure Gurav's last name, but he's India's freestyle motocross legend. He's one of the only guys to do freestyle motocross in India. There's a few of them, but he's one of them. And it's a cool park. It's all set up with like built with Indian tradition building techniques. So it's like it's literally really nice building, but the building's made of like literally sand, cow dung, and this is used for the rendering, but they use like a mixture of sand and cow dung and like some broken up fibers, kind of like straw or timber, and they make like a concoction of it and then use it to render. And then the roof is made of bamboo, and I mean, it's really nice. It's 25 degrees all year round, so it's really pleasant inside. It's got glass windows and it's got electricity in it, and they've got a men's and ladies, you know, outhouses and a little canteen and a duck pond and tree, and there's a moat and there's a lot of shade and green grass. It's really nice. And they've got a couple of different tracks set up for different levels and a freestyle motocross jump and enduro loop. So it's pretty cool. It's something that a place that I hope to come back to sometime and do some coaching or just, you know, some riding experiences with people. But, you know, India's so one of the world's biggest populations. And if you're into cricket, you're a god here. And you know, if you're a cricket professional, you're a god, I should say. And as far as motor racing goes, there's not much knowledge on it, even though everyone rides motorcycles. You know, the road is littered with them. But they don't really understand it. But, it's cool. I mean, it's exciting. You know, I'm seeing, you know, in obviously I'm getting on, and at 40 years old, you know, I've experienced a lot, and I think there's a new wave of motorcycle kind of evolution coming with the whole electrification of the motorcycle industry. And I just see a lot of opportunities here in India, so it's cool to be here. It's cool to have my family here, and stoked to be able to get a little break in my schedule to talk to Steve Summerfield.
Mate, wow. Thank you. To be honest, I was very surprised you'd even have the time, because I thought, oh, he's traveled to India very quickly after that Freestyle King show last weekend. So I didn't know why you were there. I had no idea. But as soon as I found out you already pinned it halfway across the world, I thought, oh, he's going to be a busy boy.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can even find time. So I'm really stoked that that you did tonight, mate. Actually, this park that you're talking about, is it an off-road place that will be open 365 days of the year that people can come ride bikes? Is that what the aim of it is?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure it's 365 days of the year. I'm thinking it's tailored to the weekends, you know. But okay. With the recent lockdowns here, they did close the gates, but it's still there and it's set up, and it's very impressive to get there, especially like when you travel through, you know, central India here and you see – the roads are just, you know, just laden with trash. The trash in India is – have you ever been to India?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, back in 2012. Yeah, 10 years ago.
It's crazy, right? It's like
– yeah.
You just don't understand. Like, they keep their places, their own personal places clean, but all the trash they get, they just throw it over the fence, and then it's out of sight, out of mind. And you know, saying to Gurav on the property, I'm like, where's all this trash coming from? He's like, oh, the neighbors, they just throw it over the fence. I'm like – what the hell, man? So it's everywhere. So like all through the streets, it's just like, it's hard to explain. I put a post on my story on Instagram, the other day. It's probably already gone, but we're just driving through, and I was like, we're driving through the slums, and I just hit record and just started filming, and I was just like, you know, I saw from like everything from like little kids, you know, beating up another little kid. So I captured some violence. I captured like cows and donkeys and elephants and, you know, camels and all kinds of wildlife on the streets, dogs.
Really?
Everywhere. Yeah, just everywhere. And then, I mean, people like literally beds on the street, like within a foot from the cars. It's hard to kind of really explain it. You have to see it to understand it, but it's just, yeah. So getting back to the point, yes, the motorcycle park is open because of the lockdowns. He's closed the doors right now, but I believe it's going to be up and going. And it's, yeah, I mean, he's more tailored towards coaching people and giving people experience of off-road and kind of, you know, the track's pretty, like, the level of it's quite safe and for amateur riders, but there's definitely something there for everyone.
That's cool.
He even has a distance ramp that he's jumped 188 feet on. So when you drive in, you drive through this massive big ramp that's – and I said, oh, that's cool. Like, where'd you build that? And he goes, oh, actually, when you jumped the football field, I took a screenshot and I kind of figured out the design from your screenshot and I had a guy come and build it. So he goes, it's a copy of one of your ramps. So
You're going to pull the KTM out and give it a shot? Give it a test run over 188 feet, or are you going to leave it alone?
I mean, I would. I looked at it. I said, I would like to jump that. Even just the gap it's set up, it's not that big. And I was like, I'd jump that, you know, cold, but it's not what I'm here to do. And
yeah,
it's kind of like the bush around it has grown up. So you'd have to get in there with the machine. It's not set up. So it's probably a good excuse for me to just leave that one alone on this trip.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk yourself out of that one is probably a good idea, maybe. If you're not there to do it and you go hurt yourself doing something stupid when you've got an actual plan.
Where this guy really walked in. Sense.
Hello.
Hey, how you going?
Doing good. How about you?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. Not too bad. Bloody hell, you're having a holiday.
Yeah,
everybody's there.
Yeah, they're doing their schoolwork, so they're in the other room doing the schoolwork. And Cruz came and helped me today. We went out and, like I said, we just did a shakedown at the bike and rode the track. So Cruz came out and got away from the brothers, you know, because all five of us in this apartment, you know, it kind of gets a little tedious, especially when the kids are doing schoolwork. They hate doing their schoolwork. So we get them divided for a little bit. But yeah, Cruz is in the house.
What was the kids' response as you're driving through India? Like you said, you can't explain it until you're there, and I completely agree. After I was there, it's like a completely different world. But yeah, what was the response from the kids?
I don't know, Chris. Come tell us your response of India. I'd like to hear it from his own words.
Hey, boss.
Hello.
So yeah, man, welcome, nice to meet you. I've never even met you, nice to finally meet you here. How was it, traveling over there in India?
It's very nice. It's some places are disgusting, others aren't, but yeah, it's like half built buildings everywhere, there's people living on the street, stop at a stop sign, and like people are begging on the street and stuff.
Yeah.
Sad to see.
Oh no! Yeah.
I mean, so they're seeing it, you know, and it's. I mean, it'll leave a lasting impression with them, and I'm glad I got to bring them here because I know when I first came, I couldn't, you know, I'm trying to go home and explain to the kids when they're complaining about, you know, their Fitbit chargers not working and their iPads, you know, aren't charged, or whatever. I'm like, it doesn't matter, you know, and so to bring them here and. Cruz is, you know, beyond his years, so he's kind of, it's more for the other two siblings to embrace.
That's fair enough too. How was it though, like seeing camels and elephants and everything else on the street? Like that part of it, I think, is pretty wild.
It was crazy. There was like monkeys. Today I saw a pig.
Yeah. Really?
Lots of pigs. So they had the pigs So they put all their trash in the street, then the pigs go through and eat all the food scraps. You know, they just use them to, there's not like waste management coming around emptying bins out the front of their houses every week. Yeah. So they just put all their trash into a pile. And then, you know, once every 6 months or something, they might clean the pile up or just whatever. But literally cows are sacred. It's the cows walk along and the cows end up eating the plastic, which is really sad. Ooh. And then the cows end up dying from plastic getting caught in their internals. But
yeah,
it's a bad setup. But there's pigs everywhere. There's monkeys and the elephants. You know, it's kind of sad because it's just they don't understand anything different. You know, but it's the elephants are quite done up with like colors and makeup on them. You know, so they're all like fancy and stuff. And
yeah, are you both into cricket, or one of you into cricket, or anything like that, or not at all?
I don't think the kids have ever played cricket.
Well, no?
Front yard I have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe front yard cricket.
Okay. Only because when I was there, I was in Pune, which is just maybe 2 hours south of Mumbai.
Yeah.
And I remember we drove over a bridge over a river, and there was the dry riverbed, and it was fairly wide. It was a wide dry bed. And on the banks, there must have been about 10 games of cricket going on in the dust. And I thought, oh, man, these they just love it. And that one really stuck with me, how much they love their sport. Obviously, we're into motorbikes, so it's a little bit different. But, yeah, I was just wondering if you're into cricket or not.
Yeah, I was. So we got all these landmarks. We're filming here in Jaipur. There's a lot of, like, a lot of India's, like, famous landmarks. A lot of them are in this area. It's pretty condensed for that. And
that's cool.
One of them's called Patrika Gate, and so that's where we start filming tomorrow. But we were there 2 days ago, just kind of going through there with the film crew and talking about camera angles and all the kind of stuff and what the action's going to comprise of. And there's guys playing cricket there. So yeah. I was actually standing out in the outfield waiting to catch one of them out, but the ball's never come our way. But no. I was gonna get in there and have a bat, but I thought I'd just I didn't want to intrude on the game. They probably would have bowled me out first ball anyway.
Yeah.
But you know, you see little, like, we walked through the slums yesterday too, and there's little kids playing cricket. So it's like, you know what cricket's like. It's a fun game to play. I mean, I grew up at school playing cricket at lunchtime, most lunchtimes. Yeah. So it's a fun game. It's easy to do, and you don't really need too much to do it. So you definitely but it's serious for them over here, man. It's like where we're filming at, I go into the cricket stadium, and they've already said, like, there's no way that motorcycle's going on the cricket pitch.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah.
It's almost
sacred land, man. Yeah, you can't go tearing up sacred land with a dirt bike.
There's no conversation. It's the only more awkward thing to ask someone is to talk about beef.
Oh, yeah, well, don't go doing that.
I was like, damn, where'd I get a hamburger here? And they're just like, there's crickets. There's no one said nothing. I was like, oh, shit, that's right.
Yeah.
No ham.
Yep, there you go. The joys of traveling, international travel. Well, actually, while you're standing there, Cruz, obviously, you know, you really want to go and do your schoolwork, I know, but if I could just ask a couple of questions before, I'm sure you probably do have to go. How was it riding your first freestyle show? It was the first one, right?
Yeah. It was so
at Freestyle Kings, yeah.
An amazing time. It's a 45-foot ramp. Threw out my goggles into the crowd. That was my favorite bit.
That was the best part. Got a sponsorship for those goggles, I hope, because you got to keep replenishing them every time. Dad's the sponsor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. See, when you're paying for the goggles and you get excited and you're throwing them out to the crowd. And then you start realizing, oh, crap, I can't keep doing this. So you jump 45 foot at your first show. Did you throw any tricks out?
I wanted to. I really did. But my mom said no. So I didn't do it.
Oh, come on.
It was my first show, so I could understand.
Yeah, and I told him, I said, man, it's like, okay, you know, one perspective to look at it, he's definitely capable of doing tricks and could have got there right now, but we're not pushing him. And but it's cool. Like, I'll wait till he wants to do it. And after this show, he definitely wants to get back and learn tricks. So I was like, dude, wait, you know, do it next time. It's all good. It's all good.
Exactly. Yeah. I only asked the question because I did see the Sunrise interview that the both of you did maybe a week or two ago. And you said the same thing. Mum wasn't going to let you do the trick. So I already knew you knew that, but I wondered if you broke the rules when, you know, you're in the heat of the moment, you're in the show, the spotlight's on, and you say, stuff you, Mum, I'm going out and throwing down.
I was like, gosh, what can I do? I was like, maybe I could slap the fender or something. the second time I hit it, so I followed him the first jump, and then the second jump I didn't follow him.
Yeah.
And like, I landed right on top, and I only had one jump left, so I was like, no, I'm not doing any tricks.
Yeah, in the riders meeting before the show, they're like, all right, Cruz, how many jumps do you want to do? And he goes, oh, I'll do like seven. They're like, you do. So, you know what the shows are like. It goes so quick, and Yeah, so he got three jumps. So I was but proud of him. One jump was following me, and like I said, two on his own. His second jump became a little short. Third one was amazing.
Yeah.
Perfect. So
that's cool. Start.
It was great.
How did it feel then as you're coming into the arena or, you know, that stadium there at Gosford? And I mean, you ride at home or you ride wherever you're training all the time, and then you turn up at a show, and obviously you've seen your dad do this all the time, but when somebody tells you, okay, get in position and now you've got to jump, did you feel any like, okay, this is real?
So nervous.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm doing this right now.
Yeah.
I was that nervous too. Like before, I wasn't nervous in practice. And then I was nervous. And then right as I was looking at the jump, I was like, gosh, what if I go short or go long? I was so nervous.
I mean, a fraction short, that's not an issue at all. Normally, normally if you're nervous, you're going to give it a bit more gas and kind of overshoot it. So it sounds like you held your nerve pretty well.
Yeah.
He did great. You know, kind of like spoke to him and got him a little bit mentally ready for it prior, you know, when we're at home. Well, I even said, like, imagine that there's a stadium full of people watching you while you're doing this. And then while you're aware of the stadium there, just focus on everything you need to focus on. Just being in the right gear, the right body position. You know, everything technically what you need to do right, and essentially you know that they're there, but you're focusing on what you need to focus on, and he's able to do that. And yeah, that's the key to getting through a show, and it's
that's it.
And so he did it like a champion, and I was very proud.
Mate, that is awesome. That's so cool to hear. Actually, I mean, this is something I probably don't think of anymore, but just what you said then, like to be prepared and to be focused. When you were about to jump, was the crowd going, like, were they really loud, or was the music really loud that you couldn't even hear what gear you were in or anything like that? Or did you just block all of it out and you jumped fine?
Gosh, I blocked it all out. I was so focused.
Yeah?
Yeah, I was like counting the gears. And then I don't remember. I think it was at the show or I was in practice, but I missed a gear.
Oh.
And then luckily I was clicking gears like way before I had to hit the ramp. So I had time to click it, but yeah, I was really nervous.
Fair, cool. Well, hang on. You're on a 65, right?
Yep.
So what gear do you need to be on a 65 to make 45 foot?
Fourth.
Fourth?
I tried third on this backside of the landing.
Oh, okay. All right. I mean, how difficult is that then for you, Robbie? Like, you can't say go in second gear like you would for a normal jump on a normal, you know, on a big size bike. Like, you can't give directions. You've got to let him kind of work it out.
He knows it's fourth, so he's got kind of like, he's got a 48 rear sprocket, so it's kind of like shortly geared, you know. But yeah, he just like, we have it so he makes the turns. He does all his gear changing on the way down and make sure he's in third gear. And when he turns to the ramp, he's got one gear change to make from third to fourth. And then he knows he's in fourth well before he gets to the ramp. And he's focusing on his body position and a smooth power off the ramp, staying neutral. And that's the keys. And, you know, prior to that, he had a crash at home when he actually hit the ramp in third gear. And it looped him out because it had a bit more, you know, a bit more aggression. And it kind of looped him out and he let go, right?
Yeah.
And then he didn't jump the ramp for a while, so it was cool. Like, you know, I didn't push him, but he had like the fear side of it, and he thought maybe he was never going to jump a ramp again. And then he got to the point where he's like, oh, I'm ready. I want to jump the ramp again, Dad. I'm like, hey, you're more than ready to do it. Just you got to remember what happened last time. So we made those conscious changes of like, hey, let's make a gear change here, and let's do this and set up this. So we got a system. And then, you know, it kind of helps you just when we moved it from Temecula to Gosford, we already had the system well rehearsed where there wasn't too much for him to change or to think about. It was just like more going back to the basics of, you know, we have a routine. So it's, you know, it's kind of just, it's a safety thing really. And, you know, I've learned it from my own shortfalls. You know, we do this stuff. And so that's why I'm able to like pass on this stuff to Cruz, and he's doing a great job of like, you know, listening, and he listens to, you know, obviously Tucker Higashino rides with us a lot, and we have so many guys come to the compound who are all amazing riders. So he's learned from the best of them, and proud of him.
That's cool. Hell yeah. Have you got any mates that you're train, like that you're riding with, and at, you know, same sort of age or not?
He does. Chris has like a lot of friends at Temecula, like, you know, that they all race and they all want to come and ride the compound, but we're just so busy that it's like, it's not really a place that we like bringing heaps of people around, because it's just, I mean, it's like our time when Cruz gets to ride is usually right before he does schoolwork in the mornings when we all ride. So it's usually just him there. His brother rides a little bit. His brother's like hitting the ramp as well, but not the big ramp. He's hitting 30 foot and he's about to step up to the bigger ramp. So, but there's a lot of kids that want to come and ride, but we just haven't made it a priority to kind of hand out those invitations yet, just because we got so much other stuff going on. It's kind of that right time hasn't happened yet, but we will, yeah. You know, we're definitely open to it. And as they get older, like, you know, it's been a bit of work, and it's with Cruz jumping the ramp, it's taken some months for us to get to where he's at, you know? So I don't want to bring other kids over who are young and vulnerable and put them in a situation. It's not my kid, you know, it's on our property. Yeah. We have some liability there. So a bit of a gray area. Like a lot of people ask to come and ride, and we're good at changing the subject.
Fair call. Yeah, no, I know that one. My mum was like that. I always wanted to have friends come and ride with me, but you know, you got the farm, and if someone's gonna hit a log or something and break their neck out in the paddock, and do you lose the farm over it or whatever it might be? So it was always one of those ones where mum would change the subject very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So yeah,
I'd like to, and yeah, there might be opportunities that happen, and for certain kids, like the kids who are, you know, are great at riding, and then I feel like, oh, this person's not a worry, sure. But there's a lot of kids that come over who necessarily don't want to do it, but their dads want them to do it, you know.
And
they're the ones where I'm like, you can see the kid's terrified, the dad's going, "You've got it, just hit the ramp, do what Cruz does." I'm like, I don't want that situation in the house.
No. No. That's a red flag for sure.
Yeah,
definitely, man. But so hang on. You traveled from Temecula to Gosford. You did the show. You've now traveled from Gosford to India, and you're still doing schoolwork. How is that going to work with school? Like, are you getting the work done, or are you kind of just fudging it and having a holiday?
Kind of. So like I...
Jagger's over here behind going,
nothing. We're doing nothing.
No, Jagger smashed it, haven't you, Jags? Yeah, Jaggy's done all his schoolwork. Cruz is like, did his show in Gosford, so he's a little, how far behind are you?
Not that far behind.
Not that far behind.
No, he will
get it done. He'll catch up. So it's all good.
I do all the stuff that I hand in, right?
Yeah.
So, like, there's a certain amount of work they hand in each week.
Yeah.
So I've done all that work, but then I haven't done like the extra stuff.
Yeah.
Oh. The assessment. So that's,
well, no, I've done the assessment.
Oh, that.
But
the
I haven't done the other stuff.
Okay.
Yes. So now that's what I'm doing right now. I'm doing all the assignments.
Assignments.
Yeah.
So they're good. Okay is enough.
Yeah, Amy's like a great teacher. There's a bed over here that's full of year six and year three books. So they've got all their curriculum here, and it makes for heavy bags when you're traveling. You've got all these school books, but they're homeschooled. So this is the life we live, and the kids do school on the road and they get it done.
Okay. So you don't go to school. You are homeschooled then?
Homeschooled.
Uh-huh. Right. Because that's something that's always, you know, obviously the last 8 years I've been living in Germany. I don't have kids, so I don't have to worry. But I was wondering, like, how, if I had kids, I don't know German, so I wouldn't be able to help a kid go to a school in Germany. And I thought, would I have to homeschool? How the hell does that work? And then
there's English speaking schools though.
Oh, not where we are. I'm in a small village, so there won't be an English speaking school here.
Yeah. I love Germany. It's but yeah, I mean,
Got to do what you can do. The kids are on Australian curriculum, so we do that. That's cool. Work comes out of Queensland, and we're just gonna roll with punches, I guess.
How is it then? Like, I don't know how homeschooling works. How is it that, like, are they sending you a whole bunch of assignments, like you just said? Do you then have to do video chats with them with weird time zone differences or anything like that?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, like, yeah. So yeah? Like America, I
once a week, right?
No, it's three times a week. Is it three times?
Three times a week.
Three times a week. So, like, in America, I'm pretty sure one of them are on Sunday, the other one's on Tuesday.
So it's Monday, Wednesday, Friday in Australia, right? So it's Sunday, yeah. Tuesday,
and then the last
Thursday.
One's on Wednesday.
On Wednesday,
I think.
Yeah, right. So yeah, you have to time it all for talking with the teachers. Tough gig, hey? Tough gig.
It's interesting.
So yeah.
We got money traveling. We got pencil cases and pencils and school books and, you know, all this kind of cool stuff, you know.
Hey mate, that's what I use to design all the track designs. I said to Rachel just before we did Red Bull Dirt Diggers a couple of years ago, oh, you know, she was downstairs, can you throw up my colouring in pencils? She's like, what for? I'm like, oh, I've got to do some track design. So, yeah, don't worry. The colouring in pencils go when you're 37 years old too, not just – what are you, 11 years old? Man, crazy. So, actually, what does Mum think of you doing all this? Is she pumped or is she a bit nervous?
That would be a question for her, but I think she's,
she's okay with it.
I don't think
she's super excited. I think she's, like, ultimately sees a career path change at some point, but while at the moment we got green lights, so it's doing it, and it's not coming from me. I didn't want Chris to do this. But I was like, whatever the kids want to do, whatever their choice is, it's up to them, and then they can do whatever they want to do. But for now, where our life's at, you know, the next 5 years, I see myself still being actively involved in riding my bike. So, but, you know, definitely by the time I'm 50, I'll be off the motorcycle. And at that point, I don't know, we'll reassess. But right now, you know, we're just having fun, and the kids get to, he's, you know, just seeing the glow on his face at Gosford and being involved with that show was really something special. So, while ever they're having experiences like that, I think it's a good thing.
Mate, that is awesome. That is so cool that you got to do that. It's something not many riders would ever do. It's not something many people get to really do, you know. Yeah. Do something that you actually love doing with your kids and see them also excited. So, no, it was awesome to see. Josh just sent me through the video or the little highlights video from the show. And
it's cool, huh?
I haven't – yeah, that looks so good. It looked like a really cool show and a good location.
Well, it was good. We got lucky with the weather. Like when he said it was an outdoor at Gosford, I was like, oh, man, you know, with the weather. And then now, like literally the day after the show, it started raining and it hasn't stopped since.
Really?
You know, the whole state flooded. So it's crazy.
I guess all the rain from Queensland's come down into New South Wales now. So
seems like it, yeah. It's pretty wild.
I guess they'll be copping that one. I was wondering how, when you watch Cruise Ride now, do you look back and think about your old man Pete? Like, what he would have felt when you were coming through, especially when freestyle was new when you started? Like, nobody knew what we were really doing. We were just kind of doing it, and you guys created the pathway at that time. Like, do you think about what your dad must have felt back then?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess so. Like, my dad never really supported me doing freestyle motocross, so that was like I kind of did that on my own after. Like, my dad was around, like involved with my life when I was racing motocross, you know, from 6 till 16. Yeah. And then after that, I pretty much have been on my own path since, you know, like I kind of left the house at 16 and been doing my own thing since. So freestyle motocross has been, you know, he helped me, gave me a place to ride when I first started. Mm-hmm. Babe wasn't really that fond of me quitting my not my apprenticeship, but I was a tradesman electrician. But he thought I was crazy for leaving the trade to follow motorbikes. But it's honestly probably the best thing I ever did. So, but yeah, I mean, growing up riding motocross and how like life was and the relationship with my dad back then and how we're doing it, I'd like to think we're doing it a lot differently. But it's just
what is the difference between you and your old man back then and now?
I mean, when I grew up, I was obviously we're racing motocross, so it was just a lot different. You know, it was like we were racing every weekend, and it was cool. Like my parents had me race just to get out of like being the little kid with nothing to do, down hanging at the shops. You know, with all the other little kids in the street, we kind of like no real direction. So we got into motocross as something that, you know, kept us busy and kept us like fit and good life experiences. But it was we haven't really gone that route, you know. Like I haven't taken these kids to essentially any motocross races. We're going to the Day in the Dirt down south next week, which we're excited for. The kids want to race, but I just don't like 40 kids condensing into a first-hand corner. You know, I just don't see the really much purpose unless I know they're going to get the whole shot and win the race. I'm cool with that, but I just don't want them. I've already seen Jagger at the Futures race at Supercross, like come down there with not much race craft experience and just hit the rear wheel of the other kids in the outside coming across and just cartwheel. And luckily Jagger's a strong little guy. He bounced up and was all good. But, you know, we just see there's horror stories all over the place of like little kids, you know, you're having these unfortunate crashes. And I know there's, I see pros and cons to it. I mean, I love my kids. I think the ability wise, they have the ability to go and ride at a high level and do some great stuff. But, you know, with all these championships as kids, I just don't think it really matters too much. You know, really the critical time is when you turn, you know, around the 17, 18 years old. If you want to go down the path of riding dirt bikes at that age, then let's address it then. But I'm not really going to be taking my kids all over the country, the world, chasing, you know, mini championships, and just all the work and the dedication and the risk that's involved in that. I just don't see the upside to it. You know, I'd rather take my kids to Hawaii and go surfing, or I'd rather see them like become educated and become pilots or you know, whatever it is, learn music, be a DJ, or grab a golf club, learn to play golf or something. I don't know. I just
whatever. Yeah.
Across, I mean, it's cool, but it's brutal. Like, look at even like that crash with Jet Lawrence and Faulkner on the weekend. Those two guys at the head of the sport, talented dudes. It's just like all these. Every time you watch Supercross, it's just, you know, just luck of the way that, you know, the way that the pieces fall together. People just get hurt, and it's not necessarily their fault. You know, and I just don't want kids to be one of those statistics.
Yeah, it's knife-edge sort of stuff. Like, to be the best, you have to be on the gas so hard, and you have to expect more out of the bike than it can give you, and have a lot of luck on your side, I think. Like,
sure.
Oh, the bike's kicking me. No, well, you probably shouldn't be seat bouncing so hard into a takeoff going so fast or whatever it might be, but you're like, you have to do it to win.
Yeah. Especially like you see the tracks wear away, you know, and then the whoops get cups in them, and they're still forced to charge through the whoops flat out, even though they're super dangerous. And then, you know, you just see guys just going, like, you know, Cooper Webb has not been able to skip through the whoops in at the end of like the night, shows something, you know. So it's like, and then you see people like, whoever it is, but like, we'll get up on top of the whoops and do it fine 90% of the time, and then one time we'll get all crossed up and have a like close call, and you're like, oh, it could have been dangerous. Then you see someone cartwheel and go over the bars, and luckily they didn't snap their neck, and they're just so lucky. And I'm like, you look at there's just a lot of people that have had spinal cord injuries, you know, in the whoops, and I nearly died in the whoops, you know, when back when we were doing spin style at X Games in 2012. And yeah, it's just, I don't know, motorcycles, dangerous for sure. It's like, it's a love-hate battle. It keeps me awake sometimes at night. I love it for the kids in certain aspects, but other times I'm like wary of it. So, yeah, it's a tough topic. But at this point, the way we're dealing with it today, we're good.
You're happy with the decisions you've made to this point. So then, if you're not riding bikes, you said you're surfing, or what else are you guys up to? Like, what else gets you excited?
Skating. I love
skating.
Yeah. What's called half pipe.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
We have a little mini ramp at home, so Cruise skates. So does Jags a little bit. Just another good thing to get outside, you know, be able to kind of good heart rate. They're on the trampolines a lot. We just built a pump track at the house, so they've got a cool little like bike track there for their Stasic electric BMX bikes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's really cool. One of my buddies built that for him, and it's an awesome little track. Actually,
I just saw the video of that a little while ago because I thought, man, Cruz is coming in fast. I didn't realize it was electric. Like, whoo, then that makes more sense. It was an electric one.
Yeah, the electric bike. So we've got this cool little track there. They rip on that. And then the boys have been, I've been skydiving a lot. So we've been taking them to the wind tunnel. So they're starting to get the feel for what it's like to have wind flow around their joints at 150 mile an hour. And, but we go into the, but we take them surfing a bit. And mostly a bike, our lifestyles are on bicycles, but we try to go to the beach. You know, luckily in Southern California, the weather's pretty good. So we get to the beach, you know, a couple of times a month, and they're in the pool pretty much 90% of their life when the weather allows for it.
Are you thinking you might put on the plates or whatever you'd call it for the KTM 65 and try go ride some water, or going to try something like that?
Been many requests. I was actually brought up at dinner like this week. Dad, do you think you could put a water bike out of a 65 or an 85? So he's already seen himself going to an 85 pretty soon and asking like you put it on an 85. So my answer was yes. So we'll see what happens.
Oh. Well, I did see you smiled a lot then when I said it. So I can't wait to see that. That'd be pretty damn awesome actually.
Yeah, it'd be cool. A lot of work in for someone, one or two people standing here.
Oh, mate. How is it with dodging off topic a little bit there, but the stunt work that you do, obviously we know you've done everything. Well, you've got the world records. Yeah, you should probably go and do a bit of work, mate. I can't keep you here all night because it must be getting a bit late there. So awesome to meet you again.
Yeah, good.
And thank you, and great to catch up.
Yeah. See you, Steve.
See you, boss. See you later, man.
See ya.
Man, that was awesome. That was cool. I thought, it's probably going to be late there. You guys are probably
It's quarter to 6 p.m.
It's not too bad actually in India, is it?
I've got a production meeting that's going to start in an hour's time, so I'm just kind of killing some time, which is why. Talking to you right now made some sense. I was just going to be chilling here, reading the news or playing block puzzle or doing emails or something stupid like that, you know. So I thought, why not have a healthy conversation?
Doing some wordles and whatever else. Well, I guess that probably makes sense then, because I wanted to segue a little bit into the stunt work.
Yeah.
And the difference between you doing your what you want to do versus doing the movie work, but I guess what you want to do gets dragged across into the movies anyway. You did Xander Cage with the water bike, but you already did that yourself anyway. So how does the stunt work go compared to actually being a freestyle motocross rider for you?
You know, I've got a lot more patience as I got older. Like when I was younger, there's no way I could have done it. I probably wouldn't have, I actually did do some stuff earlier on and I never got invited back, probably just because of like my energy at the time. But now that I'm a bit older and a bit more relaxed and I get it a bit more, I'm able to kind of don't need to be in the spotlight all the time. I don't need the tension all the time. I don't need to be always moving and, you know, cracking jokes or pissing people off. So, you know, my sons have taken over those roles for me, but it's, it's different, man. It's like I enjoy it, and it's like, yeah, it's taught me a lot of patience, because you're on those film sets and it's like, you know, you'll get the action call maybe, you know, when you're on it might be like, you know, every couple of takes, but then you get that scene done and like, all right, move on, then the cameras will go and move to a different scene, and it might be an hour before you get back on the bike again. So there's a lot of downtime, and for some people, like, they can't handle that, and it's like boring and they don't want to do it. But to me, I've had a bit of a change of like the way I perceive and navigate the world. So I'm just kind of like happy, you know, in the present moment. So I'm kind of like, I'm not bored, or like when things take time, I'm like, it's all good. I'm not stressed, you know? So
yeah,
it's, so having that nature, like, allows me to, like, I don't get over it, or like, you know, I'm able to stay focused throughout the day, and I appreciate doing it too. I really enjoy the work. So that obviously makes it a lot better. Like, I like delivering what the director or the producers want, you know, the stunt coordinator, whatever, whoever's calling the shots, what they explain, what they want. And then I try and give them exactly what they want. And so I have great pride in that. And then it's just cool, like, to be able to take on, you know, where it throws you, you know. Like, the other week I did a Super Bowl commercial for DraftKings, and it was like a DraftKings commercial that was on Super Bowl, and it's Evel Knievel. There's the girl who's a character in all these DraftKings, in the DraftKings commercial. She's having all these different experiences, and one of the experiences, she's like on the back of the motorcycle, Evel Knievel does a jump, and I was Evel Knievel in the suit, which is really cool. I got to jump an old Triumph like he did, and jumped one of like his replica ramps. So it's a lot different, but it's cool. It's teaching me a lot. You know, I'm getting to work with amazing professionals in the stunt community, and I'm getting to learn like safety, you know, safety is so paramount there. And then just the whole etiquette of being like waiting and just waiting your turn. And, you know, I'd be the guy, like, when I'm on my dirt bike riding around, like, I'm a chook with my head cut off, popping wheelies everywhere and doing endos. And on a film set, you can't do that. You have to, like, literally do the stunt and then return back to the start point as safely as possible. And it's a different way of riding, but I'm still honestly, like, as far as, like, the hours on set goes and stunt guys, I'm literally just a beginner, but I've done obviously some of the biggest roles in some of the biggest movies, like with, you know, 007 and recently with Jason Statham on Expendables 4. So it's cool, man. I love doing the work, and it's a lot of fun, and just great experiences. I'm really kind of honored with this last experience doubling with Jason Statham. He become a mate, and we kind of stayed in contact, and so yeah, I'm excited to where that may lead us, and hopefully I get to do some more work with him in the future. That'd be really cool.
Do you have to go and jump in the gym and buff up a little bit if you've got to be a stunt double for these guys?
Oh, mate,
there's the gun show.
Not essentially. Like, I'm luckily, like, I stand 5'9", 5'10", with boots on. You know, Jason's probably a little bit shorter than me, but once you get on a motorcycle, if I'm 5'10", I can be doubling someone who's, like, from 5'4 to literally like 6 foot, and you can't really tell too much in the scenes that they use. You know, in this last film, Jason's wearing like, you know, army kind of gear with the big jacket and, you know, and machine gun on and all this kinds of stuff. So once you put all the stuff on, it's like it kind of gets lost in the mix. But when I doubled Vin Diesel, obviously, yes, I had to do testosterone for 3 months. And no, I'm joking. They had like a foam suit that went over me that was like, you know, had the muscles on it, which was pretty uncomfortable because I had this like bulky suit on me, and then I'm riding the water bike, and at the time the water bike wasn't working too well, so I kept falling off in the water, and this foam suit would just suck this water in, and then I couldn't take the suit off because like it was a mission to get on, so I'd have to have the big guys on set give me bear hugs to like squeeze all the water out of it. And I take the suit off at the end of the day, and my skin would, like, you know, when you sit in the hot tub too long and your hand looks like a grandma's, like, my whole body looked like that. But, so there's ways around it. When I doubled James Bond, you know, the whole scene where it was with no helmet, but I had, like, a cap that went on my pinhead to make the hairline and the head dimensions the same as Bond's. And there's a scene there where I'm riding across the roof of the Grand Bazaar, and it's literally my body with Daniel Craig's face morphed onto my body. Again, as the guy was asking me on this production that I'm on right now, like, oh, how did, so Jason, uh, Daniel Craig was actually on the motorbike on the rooftop. I'm like, no, it was me. And it took about a 5-minute conversation for him to understand how that happened. So, yeah, there's bits and pieces where, you know, you have to buff up and stuff. But obviously I'm just doubling these guys for the motorbike scenes. I'm not their overall stunt double. So yeah, on some of these films, you know, for these lead actors, there might be 5, 10, sometimes 20 different people doubling the same actor. So they have their main doubles, like Bobby Hanton Holland is one of my good mates, and he doubles Chris Hemsworth, and he's Chris's like main stunt double, and they literally look like twins, you know, to the way they stand, the shapes of their muscles, everything. So, you know, I'm kind of lucky that I'm on the bike. I don't have to be a total, you know, Zach double, but hopefully in the future I might have to be something like that. Who knows?
Man, it's a completely different world. It's just so different.
Like for me, it's like it's all kind of it's not brand new, but it's always intriguing. You got the honey wagons where you get change, you have your own change rooms, and it's like, you know, from being motocross, freestyle motocross, we walk in the arenas with our gear bags, and we literally like set up on concrete floors. We might have a change room at some of the nice stadiums
if you're lucky, yeah.
Everyone, but you know, and the change rooms stink like you know the smell of the change room. Everyone comes in, takes their gear off, and it's just nasty in there. But
on the film, like 10 sets of knee braces, just yeah. And moto socks, and yeah perfect. Green skins.
But yeah, it's on the film sets, it's different. You know, you all have your own kind of separate trailers, and it's definitely a bit nicer. You have like, you know, they have, you know, the food areas are set up, so you just have like anytime you want a snack or something to eat, there's food there. It's really cool. There's, so that's. And then they vary, but for the most part, you get treated really well, and the pay is good. And you know, if the SAG deal's done right, you stand to make some good residuals, and all that kind of works in nice. And it's a great opportunity to do this stuff. So I'm really, you know, when I do get the call up to do this stuff, it's an honor for me, and I love working with the stunt guys. It's I'm always learning off those guys, so it's kind of like. They're honored to have me on the set, and I'm honored to be on the set with them. So it's kind of a win-win situation.
That's really cool. Do you get to give your input on, I think this would look better, or I can do this jump, or we can slide here and pop over there? Or are they just saying, no, this is the movie and this is what we want you to do?
Yeah, for the most part, like it's not really – they don't want to see me. It's not really left up to me to do anything. You know, they usually have exactly what they want, and they're like, we want you to do this. And then you're like, oh, you get like this itch and think, oh, this will look cool. And you come in and do it the way you want to do it. And they go, all right, cut, go back. All right, we want it like this. And you're like, okay. And you realize that they don't want it like that. And like when I was writing as Bond, I was writing like in my style, thinking I'd looking better. And they're like, no, we want you to be upright and stiff because that's how James Bond is, you know. So...
Is there anything that has been asked of you that you went, nah, I can't do that?
Nah, I mean, when I did the Bond thing, when I did James Bond, I just had back surgery and I hadn't actually got back on the bike yet. And I just literally, my phone rang and it's like people were trying to get in touch with me and like, hey, we want you to come out and double James Bond. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'd love to do it. We ended up figuring that situation out and I went out there and the doctor said, you should be right to ride your bike, just nothing, no compression of your spine. You want to avoid compression of your spine. And this is Dr. Rob Bray from Gist Medical in LA. He does like all Red Bulls. Gist Medical is like one of the most elite, you know, places you can go to. And Rob's like, you know, the doctors that like hate motorcycle riders. Yeah. He's not one of those. He totally understands it's our job, our livelihood. And so, he, you know, most doctors would be like, hell no, you know, you've just had back surgery only, you know, X amount of months ago, you're not ready to ride. So he gave me the all clear to go there. He said, avoid any compression. And the first day I got there, they're like, oh, we want to start with the scene where you're going to. And so I didn't even know what I was getting myself into. When they asked me to come out, they're like, oh, you know, can you come out and do this? I said, what does it comprise of? And like literally stunk away and I said, oh, you'll be able to do it with your eyes closed. It's all really easy stuff. Don't worry about it. Just jump on the plane, come over here. It's like, all right, cool. Went over there with nothing. Get there, the first thing he goes, all right, the first thing we want you to do is like ride and jump off this rooftop and land 2 stories down here on the flat ground. And actually it wasn't flat ground. It had like a 5-degree kind of, so you come in 2 stories to like an impact uphill. I'm like, dude, this is going to
An uphill.
Yeah. I'm like, this is exactly what the doctor didn't, you know, prescribe. So I did the practice. I had them, like, they actually built like a wedge for me. So I was like kind of, and essentially it looks like I'm going to the rooftops, but in the film, I come across the rooftop and I go through this glass door and in what it looks like is a building. It's actually the art department just set up this like man-made little kind of they do a brilliant job, but it looks like I go through this window. But I just went through the window into cardboard boxes. And then we reshot. And so when I come through the window again, it's actually in a part of the Grand Bazaar, and they just kind of made it look like it was a building, but it's actually like a big open area, and they put in some fake panelings and they had scaffolds. So I was riding across the scaffold and coming through the window and then dropping down into the Grand Bazaar. They had a timber wedge there, so I was dropping into the timber wedge, did it like 3 or 4 times, got the use of it, I got the feel for it. Then like, all right, now we're going to get rid of the wedge, and then we're going to put the glass panel in there. So then the next time I came through the glass panel and landed on the flat without the that was the only sketchy thing I've done. But well, it's not the only sketchy thing. When I was on Venom, I jumped the roadway and they wanted me to jump it with no helmet. And so that was probably one that I was like, nah, I'm going to wear a helmet. You know, you guys are going to CGI the crap out of this anyway. I'm going to wear a helmet. You can just CGI that off. And I go, nah, we want you to have no helmet. I'm like, you're doing the CGI. It rained as well. But, yeah, there's always – you have to have your wits about you, because if you're just a yes man and do anything they ask you for, like, depending on the stunt coordinator with you, that you might be working with someone who is setting you up to get hurt. And sometimes, you know, having the experience I have with riding bikes, you got to know when to stand your ground. And I think that's one of the main things that makes you a professional and respected is knowing, like, you know, when to say yes and no. But, you know, mainly I put myself in enough danger. It's not really the stunt coordinator's problem, but it's a lot of the work I do is with some of the top guys who are really kind of don't want to put me in danger. And so sometimes I'll be like, oh, you're going to do this jump once. You know, they're not going to let me do it 10 times. And so a lot of the times, you know, you want to avoid doing things over and over. I really get frustrated when it's like, all right, take 10, take 20. It's like, why are we doing it 20 times? I'm doing my job right. So, I mean, last time when I was on the Expendables 4, and this is no one's fault, but I just they wanted me to do a whip, an upside down whip, and I was doing it. They asked me to do if I was comfortable doing it without the helmet, and you know, they said no pressure. If you want to do it without the helmet, you can. I was like, nah, I'll do it with the helmet. You know, you can CGI it out. And I figured by the angle of the where the camera was for the majority of the shot, you know, because there's 1,000 frames per second, and that frame might only go for 7 seconds. So out of that 7,000 frames they have to edit, probably more than half of them, my head's not even in the shot because the bike's rotating on its axis and it's hidden. So I wore the helmet for that one. But on the last take, I actually landed I bulged a disc in my back, and so I landed and bulged a disc, and I was like, literally took the breath out of me, and I couldn't, I was kind of stuck at that point. I had to go get an MRI, left set. But luckily we got the shot on that take. So yeah, it's a hard one. On that specific set too, I had to do the stunt probably more than I needed to, but we got the job done. But there's random things that happen, you know, and it's like you always have to kind of be willing to respond and take care of those things. But it's, for the most part, I haven't been in any of like lower budget things with like people who aren't as experienced, because like anything, you know, if you're a budding stunt coordinator, you're going to make mistakes in your career. And luckily I'm working with guys who have probably done that, and I'm working with experienced guys who their main focus is keeping all their guys safe. So
yeah, that's it. You don't want bad news like Alec Baldwin shooting somebody on set. So I mean, I wouldn't want to think about the risk that goes through as a stunt coordinator of, I think this can work. We're going to go send Matt, I'll often do that, and then you've crashed your brains out or something. You know, it would just look horrible. It would be horrible. So
it's just because, like, well, on the film stuff too, like a lot of the danger is the pyro. So you'll be scenes where you're right, especially on Venom. You know, Tom Hardy's character is coming through the traffic there in San Francisco, and there's cars rolled over, and as he's going through there, there's all these explosions going off, right? And they have like cars rigged up with like the door hinges are barely held on with a couple of bolts. So when the explosion goes off, the door panel goes flying through the air. And there's times when the sequence is out, you know, or the fuse isn't long or whatever. And so there's thousands and hundreds of thousands, millions of stories of stunt people getting injured. And it's one of the it's actually a big point of like, you know, stunt people. After doing these films, I'm like, man, those guys and women, men and women that do stunts are in a league of their own. And I don't really necessarily want to become a stunt person because of what I experienced. You know, it's like I saw them getting injured. You know, there's a scene on Bond where Bond's character comes through and has to hit us. There's like these two roadways that meet and it's blind and the stunt coordinator saying action and they come flying down and then all of a sudden this guy comes in and just right in front of Bond and Bond's character hits him and goes over the handlebars and they did that scene like three or four times. So these guys are just having this collision three or four times and going over the handlebars, no helmets on, but they're just stunt guys are gnarly and I'm not like trying to – I'm cool being – I'm regarded as a specialist stunt guy, so I do the specialty stuff, like if it's jumping off a building or a long jump or a trick, you know, obviously tight riding and all that kind of stuff, I'm a good guy for that. But when it comes to, like, crashing, there's guys who specialize there. When there's a crash scene, like, they put on the kit and they come and do the crash, and I'm like, man, you're fucking crazy. You're gnarly. And they're like, you're saying I'm gnarly. You're gnarly. I'm like, no, we're having gnarly off in the changing room. Like,
oh, man. But yeah. It is. I looked at it as a potential job about 20 years ago. There was a stunt academy down on the Gold Coast. And I think I'd just ridden King of the Coast the first time with you, actually. And I was looking at doing this stunt academy and in the end, I didn't do it, but it always interested me. It was always something that looked kind of cool. But then the more I looked into it, I was like, oh, this is pretty nuts. Like what they have to do is pretty, obviously it's looked after and it has to get done the right way, but still things can go wrong.
One of my really good friends, Cody Mackey, he's like, in the stunt world, focuses on it. That's his daily grind, and that's what he focuses on. And whereas we're like brothers, you know. And every time I've gone on a film, I'm always like, they need another writer. I'm like, hey, get Cody, great guy, great profession, very professional. But just seeing how he's developed, like this kid grew up across the road from me in Kiama, not his whole life, but at a certain point, and he's a top racer and raced for Red Bull KTM and came and raced in you know Cody. But,
exactly.
But anyway, seeing where he's at now and you know, he's hanging out with a lot of these world's top stunt guys, right? And so Clay Cullen is one of those guys and one of the good friends of Cody's. And Cody sends me a video they did, I think it was New Year's together. They went up to Utah. And so, like, they got this, you know, mansion that they've rented and there's all these, you know, world's top stunt guys. And he sends me this video. And I guess what stunt guys do for fun is probably different than what most people do for fun. You know, I'm the type of guy that likes to hang around a bonfire and see how big we can get the fire. I mean, I think that just goes with being petrol heads. But these stunt guys, like, they're having, like, playing dead at the top of the stairs. So they're pretending to shoot each other and then they're falling, doing stair falls. So, like, they're there. Cody's in his, like, onesies, in, like, pajamas. And his buddy's down the bottom of the stairs and he's like, bang, shoots him. Cody just like goes limp and just literally falls face first down the stairs and does this amazing roll and just slides down a full flight of stairs and lands on his feet. I'm just like, that was amazing. It was so amazing. I have to send you the video so you can put it in. You can insert it.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
But I'm like, dude, So, I mean, it's a knack to it. And these stunt guys, they practice falling and they do a lot of training. But, yeah, hats off to all the stuntmen and women. I'm a huge fan of their work. And it's really impressive to see what they do. And, you know, the things they take on to make these films, I mean, it's literally mind-boggling what some of these guys do. Like, literally half the stunts. You know, nowadays, obviously, you can tell when stuff's CGI'd, but
yeah,
there's some badass stunt people that do some incredible stuff that's just, like, next level, and it's all to do with the rigging and the crews they have. Like these, they go, a lot of these crews go from film to film. It's like it's a family, and it's just of all of like amazing people all coming together and together making a team and being able to create content and do stunts that make films amazing. And it's, you know, you watch these films and some stuff happens really quickly and you just go, oh yeah, that was cool. But when to be a stunt person to watch a film, you're like actually taking, you're like, holy cow, I'm going to watch that scene again. Like, how did they film this? You know, and you kind of get intrigued into how they filmed it. It's amazing. It's cool. It's cool to be involved with it. It's a whole new world for me. And it's an area where I'm going to give it more focus in the future for sure.
That's really cool. Do you look back and think you'd go and do all the New Year's Eve stunts again, knowing what you know now from the movie side? Like, have you learnt stuff from the movies that you could put back into your own things?
Not necessarily, because all the stuff I do is just like balls to the wall. You know, a lot of the stunt stuff is shot in sequences and, you know, and together compiled to make an action scene. You know, and they have like different takes and all that, whereas I'm just doing live action. So I think my essentially New Year's Eve stuff has just been big ballsy stunts that essentially, if it was in a film, it would be much smaller and shot in different ways to make it look big. You know, they're not going to go out and do something of that nature on a film set. It wouldn't, they just wouldn't.
Oh no, definitely.
To take that danger. So they wouldn't allow someone to take that risk. So the fact that I was able to get Red Bull and ESPN to allow me to take that danger and those risks on live TV, it may never happen again.
You think?
Yeah. It's definitely an amazing time and definitely had to do with certain individuals being a part of it to allow it to happen. And ultimately it comes down to, like, you know, the people who call the shots being, you know, it comes down to one person's kind of call usually with a lot of
someone believes in you enough and says, yeah, nah, we'll go live with this. It's fine. Maddo's got it.
Yeah. No, I have to owe a lady by the name of Joan Lynch allowed my first or allowed those events happen for me. And Arjumu White, AJ White from who used to work for Red Bull. Those two guys together was a power team, Dave Mateus as well, and obviously the team at Red Bull, Chris Marta. You know, there's a lot of guys that are involved with that. Josh Kendrick, there's a lot of guys, but those group of those people, and it was even more than that that come together that allowed that to happen. And like I said, it may happen again, but who knows? But I definitely am working towards something of that nature, and we'll see, like, if I'm able to figure out to get the permissions to do it. But you know, that's why I'm kind of essentially come out of retirement. I was at a point in my life where my back pain and previous injuries had kind of got me to a point where I was just in daily pain. Now my consistency in the gym and you know, being sober and all these other things, you know, culminating and making me feel a lot better. So I'm able to be back on the bike again now, but I'm always doing yoga and stretching and stuff like that. But it's I got inspired, you know, just by certain things that happened to me a few years ago that now I'm like, fuck this. I'm not letting anything stand my way. I want to achieve this goal, and I'm willing to turn over every stone to make it happen.
That's cool. Is that Mad Will? Is that where that has come in?
Well, Mad Will is what I got to. It's what, yeah, that's that brand Mad Will is just something that we came up with because Amy and I want to have something for our kids, you know, and you know, being in the position that we've worked our way ourselves to be in, and you know, I think of myself as like, Amy's an equal part of what I do. You know, she's been with me since since day dot of me being a professional, essentially. And you know, Mad Will is like, the name Mad Will actually was made by one of my best lifelong friends, Malcolm McCassie. I've known Malcolm for almost 20 years, but just a great guy, and he's always just consistently been a good dude. And you know, I've got a lot of respect for Malcolm, and I was telling him the point I was at, and I wanted to come up with a brand, and I just wanted it to be right to me and who I'm about. And he wrote my name down, Robert William Madison, and he saw Mad Will in that. And he's like, Mad Will is cool. And he's like, it's what you've got. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, you know, you always overcome all these obstacles. You've done all this, the craziest shit ever. He's like, that's Mad Will. And so we kind of like started brainstorming on what Mad Will means. And it's who I am. It's what I stand behind. It's like being the best version of yourself you can be. And that's why I chose to give sobriety a test, because you can't be the best version of yourself while you know, having a few swigs on grandpa's cough syrup. And my principles, it's like that became more, I was doing that more than I was not doing it. And so I just decided, like, hey, I need to clean my act up. And since then I've lost 20 pounds. You know, I was kind of I was coming in around 194 pounds is the furthest I've ever pushed the scales to. And now I'm yesterday I was down at 168. So, you know, back under that 80 kilograms feels nice for sure. I'm back around about, you know, 78 kilograms. But yeah, Mad Will is like, that's the brand that we want. And that's like, that's the invitation we want to give to people to be associated with us, is to have Mad Will, to be the best version of yourself, to eat healthy, to be happy, to let go of all the bullshit, to not fight with people, to just all around, like, this is a brand that's open to everyone. There's no like group or coolness or anything like that. It's just like, we're the no bullshit guys over here that call a spade. We haven't got egos. We're here to help each other, bring each other up. We're here to do cool shit, have as much fun as we can, and fuck your image and all the bullshit you want to like have, you know, all that kind of stuff. I see it with the old brands where they just like want to have cool groups and all this kind of stuff, and they segregate other people and other people aren't cool and all this other stuff. It's like, I just don't want to be about that. You know, I want to have a brand, and it's not just the motorcycle community I'm going after either. You know, I'm like, I want to have this brand that's like everything we're into. You know, you heard Cruz, like, he's into skating and surfing, and you know, so it's a brand, it's like, it's a lifestyle brand. So we're doing that. And but yeah, Mad Will is it's going to be a part of everything I do, but no, it's not this big bold adventure that I'm going on. This is more something that I've been dreaming since I've been a little kid. And it's something at the start of my freestyle career when journalists would ask me, like, oh, you've just jumped the football field, or you just jumped London Tower Bridge, you jumped Corinth Canal. What's going to be the gnarliest stunt you ever do? When's enough going to be enough? And I used to say, when I can do this specific thing, that's when I'll call enough. And I spoke about it openly for some time, and I realized people started thinking I was a whack job. And so I stopped speaking about it, and now I'm just like, I'm just doing it. You know, I'm not going to talk about it anymore. I'm just going to do it. And once the plans are in place, then I'll talk about it, and then I'll do some, you know, build some awareness about it. But there's certain like critical things I need to get in place before I'm going to be able to confidently speak about it, because I don't want to like put it out there and have it not happen, you know. And I'm not someone that's going to sit here and talk about anything. I'm a doer, not a talker. So
there is. Yeah, there is a plan.
There is a plan.
Yeah. A plan. I like that. Stuff,
you know, I've been flying planes. I'm almost, you know, essentially this trip's going to be a month-long trip around the world. So when I get back from this, I need to finish off my pilot's license. I'm so close to finishing it off. Oh, so I just had some like issues with my medical, and that's really what I ran into, is a huge hurdle with my medical history. Yeah. So I'm trying to get that straightened out. I kind of got the go-ahead to continue being a student pilot, but I need to like figure out a couple little things there, and then just finish off and do my. I finished the written test so I've passed my written test. I just need to do the spoken test. But ultimately, all that's gonna
is there too many bones? Like, is there a limit of bones broken? They're like, nah, can't pass. Like, you're out, pal.
Probably, but you know. but no, it's, you know, yeah, it's just having a medical history. What happens is I kind of, you know, gave my medical history, and then essentially once you do that, you have to go back and get checked off for everything. So yeah, it was just a process. Once I kind of delivered what had happened, then I had to go back and get my eyes tested and do like tests with like psychologists and head doctors and
yeah, fair call though.
And you know, everything that I've had, I had to kind of get checked off on it, which I've done. And then I've sent it all in, and then I said, well, so what now? And then the FA said, well, we'll get in contact with you. And then COVID happened, and so, or not COVID, COVID was already happening, but because of COVID, I just haven't heard from them. And then when I try and look into why I haven't heard into you, it's like there's all these departments, and it's just a gnarly kind of train. And it's something that I looked into for like a couple of days, and I end up like not being able to get in touch with someone, and then next minute I had to like travel and do what I'm doing. So it all just kind of, and now I forgot. Now I even forget who I had to call. So
I'll pick up. Fair enough. No, it's funny because I think I've almost done like the world tour of your stunts. It's probably a couple of places I haven't seen, but obviously I've seen the Arc de Triomphe in Las Vegas, and I looked at it and I was like, nah, wouldn't touch that.
Have you been to Greece?
I was about to say that. I did a road trip down to Greece as my rehab tour after my last hip operation, and I was learning to walk again down in Greece, and we were just cruising along heading towards Athens from Kalamata, I think it was. And so yeah, that I was like, oh, hang on, Corinth's coming up here, and I wonder where this is going to be. Well, you can find it pretty easily where you jump, because it's the
canal. The canal is like right there, right?
Yeah. And I just, you know, when I look at you, I watched you in Brisbane at the Krusty World Record. I watched you do that. And yeah, it's a fucking big jump, but it makes sense. Arc de Triomphe, that didn't make sense, but you know, you did it. But when I saw the Corinth Canal, that one looked a little bit more nerve-wracking, as I was just thinking, how would I feel if I was doing this right now? And I shit myself looking at the Corinth Canal. I really.
Yeah, well, I mean, that jump there wasn't my idea. That was someone else's idea. And essentially, the guy that called me was Morgan Carlson. And you probably know him.
Yeah.
So Morgan's, you know, legend, great guy. He called me. Yeah. He's like, hey, I know, I've got this idea, like, to jump this Corinth Canal. I was like, oh, shit. And he's like, you know, it's totally doable. Why don't you go check it out? So I went out there and looked at it. And I got to the bridge, I looked at it, and I was just like, nah, like, it's not worth, like, why would I even bother, like, trying to jump this stupid thing? Like, it's so dangerous. If something goes wrong, you're definitely going to die. And it's death-defying, right? You stand there, you look at it, it's 300 feet down. It's scary enough walking over the bridge, let alone jumping over the thing. And so it terrified me, and I left, I did a specific trip to Greece to look at that, and I left there saying, nah, I'm not going to do it. And so a couple of years later, I was on a road trip when I was sponsored by Parts Unlimited, and I was with my team manager at the time, which his name is Slasher. What's Slasher's name? I can't think of his
name. Good enough name for me, Slasher. Damn.
I'm such an idiot. Victor Sheldon. So Victor Sheldon is world champion jet skier, badass athlete, amazing athlete. One is really good friend of Jeremy McGrath. I met Victor, was my team manager at Thor. And so we were doing the Parts Unlimited road trip, and we went up to Madison, Wisconsin for their Christmas party. And I'm coming back on the road trip, and Victor and I, you know, we're driving back to, you know, some airport, and he's like, is there ever a jump that you've ever like said no to? And I'm like, yeah, like the Corinth Canal. And he's like, why, what's up with that? And you know, he's the type of guy, he's like, wants to ask interesting questions. So I tell him, you know, I tell him like specifics of it. I'm like, you know, I just don't want to do it. Because he's like, why not? I'm like, well, if something goes wrong right before the ramp and I don't get my power off there, and I'm done, you know. I'm like, I'm literally going to die. And I'm like, the only way around that jump would be I'd have to jump with the base jump parachute, because if something did happen mechanically, I'd have to like quickly pull my chute, save myself, and I'd land in the water, and I'd have a motorcycle involved. It'd be ugly. And it just, when you start thinking about it, the mind like starts threading these graphic images, and it's just like, it's an instant no. And so then he's like, well, how many times has that happened to you in the past in your jumps? I'm like, never. He's like, well, what are you worried about? I'm like, I'm worried about the chance of if, you know? Yeah. And then he's like, well, that's stupid. If it's never happened before, like, why wouldn't you just go and do it? I was like, well, it's easy for you to say. You don't have to do the fucking jump.
Yeah.
And so I was like, and so then I'm sitting there, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to do the jump. And I just decided, really? Like, I'm going to do the jump. So he just made me see it from a different perspective. And he's like, if it's never happened to you before, why question it? I was like, okay, good point.
If you're going to bring up logical points, then, you know, like it makes sense. If you think of it logically, you're correct. Yeah. It hasn't happened before, but.
And another way that I think is like, I a lot of the times when I do my stunts, you know, one of the key things to my mindset, people ask me like, are you like sober when you do these jumps? I'm like, 100%. I'm like so clear headed when I do these jumps. There's no way people honestly think that, oh, these people must be high if they're doing this stuff. And it's like, no, we're the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, one of the ways I think is like, I've worked my whole life. Like what I do for a living is honestly like my dream come true. Like, when we're at school and teachers just say, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? Like, what is your ultimate dream? This is the lifestyle. I'm living it now of what I dreamt of. But I never had the balls to ever, like, say it in school or write it down or anything, because I didn't want anyone in class to judge me and think, oh, you want to be a famous motorbike rider and live in America? Like, my mates in Climber would have given me shit if I had said I want to live in America. But honestly, that was what I wanted. I wanted to be like Robbie Knievel, Evel Knievel, because when I was – about 10 years old, I watched Robbie Knievel jump the Caesar's Palace, and it was a special on Evel Knievel, and I got really inspired, and I was like, that's what I'd love to do that. If I could do anything in my life, that's what I'd want to do. And I never really told anyone that. And then as life goes on, I had meningitis when I was 16. And when I was on my deathbed with meningitis, I was like, why am I an electrician when all I wanted to do was be like this vision I had? So after I got out of hospital with meningitis, I finished my trade, but I remembered the feelings I had in hospital. And I was like, my heart changed. Like, before I got meningitis, I was happy to be an electrician. After meningitis and sitting in hospital, I realized I don't want to do this anymore. I want to do what I'm passionate about. So I kind of left hospital with this newfound wisdom. And then when I do these jumps, I was literally thinking to myself, I'm living the lifestyle I always wanted to live. So, you know, when I jumped on the Vegas, in the building in Vegas after Triumph, Amy's like, everyone was terrified. I was terrified. I literally had tears jumping out of my eyes when I put my helmet on. I had tears like leaping a foot out of my eyes, and I wasn't crying. I just, the stress and everything was like leaping out. And Amy's like, babe, you don't have to do this jump. Like, you know, we can quit right now, move back to Australia, be an electrician the rest of your life. I'll love you and adore you for the rest of life. Yeah. And it's just, I don't want you to do this. And I'm like, babe, I want to do it. Don't talk to me about this anymore. I'm doing it. End of story. Yeah. And the reason why I say that is because I think back and I'm like, this is what I wanted to do, and this was always my dream. So if I don't go through with doing this, then it's a disservice to the dream that I had, and I'll never be able to live my life thinking I gave it my all. Because essentially I'd be like cowardly not facing my fears to live my dreams. And that's why my motto is face your fears, live your dreams, because I had to face the fears of like what the mind wants to think about and trick you into thinking that it's a reality of like what could go wrong. Yeah. You need to face that fear and be like, no, I'm focused, I'm dedicated, I'm going to do this jump, walk this line and achieve it. And so like I used that rationality of thinking is like, and it just, I turned the fear off. I'm like, this is what I dreamt of. This is what I wanted to do. And so I'm fearlessly going to do this. And sure, like my body wants to think of the fear and my mind wants to jump to conclusions of what could and what ifs, but all that's just like you're allowing your mind to control you. and none of that's real and none of it's factual. So like, you kind of like, it's a disservice to your mad will if you want to go and allow yourself to give in to your own, you know, false thoughts that are created to you through your conditioning of how you've been taught by other people. They've put their fear into you by saying, oh, that's too dangerous because this and this and this. You might not even thought about half the things that they put into your mind, but now they put these ideas into your mind. Now you can't get rid of their fears that they've conditioned you. And so I just like, all that became too much for me. So I was like, fuck with my life like this. I'm turning that switch off. I'm not letting my mind run around in circles anymore, because I got so trapped in my own mind at a certain point in my life that I was like OCD. I used to think that it mattered like how things happened and whether I stepped on lines. I was so OCD. I was like Rain Man. I was like crazy, right? And I was literally trapped. And a psychologist said to me, like, how did you stop doing that? And I said, I just got to the point where life was so painful for me. I couldn't live like it anymore. And I just had to let it go. And none of us, we all have our own things. And so I've struggled with like certain things, you know, like, you know, tics and all kinds of things that have plagued me at certain times of my life. But it's all part of like me getting a better relationship with myself and learning how to calm myself down and breathe and just be present and do what's important for myself. And I'm still doing it, you know. And so like that's the mindset of like what allows me to get over these crazy things. And then ultimately, the thing that I'm building towards, this next feat, is like the scariest shit I've ever done, but it's still like the biggest dream I ever had. And so I'm going to go through it 100%. And people are like, oh, but you've got kids. And like certain people that are in my wheelhouse are like not wanting to support my dream because they're like, you've got too much to lose. I'm like, that's not your decision to make. It's mine. And yeah. I want to be the example to my kids. And I feel confident that I can navigate these waters and do it successfully. And I know that like the outcome of this event is going to be totally dependent upon the focus and the work ethic and you know the care that I take in the preparation, you know. And so like if I prepare properly and dot every I and cross every T, you know, proper preparation prevents piss poor performance, right? So
that's right, exactly.
If I do all that right, I know for sure that I can do what I'm envisioning, because I already know that the physics and the requirements of what I'm asking to happen is tangible and it's feasible. It hasn't been done yet. And yes, it's wild and it's crazy, but you know, they take rockets into outer space. The International Space Station's up there. There's arguments. Yeah. Have we been on the moon or not? I don't know. I didn't want to get into that. I believe they have, maybe they haven't, but I know that life is a lot different than what we're led to believe. And, you know, I know that we have a spiritual element to us. So life's a lot deeper than face value of what you see on Instagram and all this kind of stuff. So to me, this is more of a spiritual path, and me achieving this is really me trying to reach my full potential, which comes back to mad will. And so all this stuff is all in, it's all in a big circle. And so I'm excited, and it's like, that's why I have no problems being sober now. I don't even feel pressure to like drink or anything, because I'm like, I'm so stoked just with the energy we got going on and what I'm teaching my kids. And the challenge I have ahead of me is going to require me to give it everything I have and more. And I wouldn't be able to do it if I'm not doing what I'm doing now. So that's why I'm chugging water and eating well and just staying busy, and that's why I have the time to connect with you, because I'm punctual now and I'm mindful of my time. It's crazy how that's so
I didn't expect to hear something like that from today. That is sure. And
it's crazy how my motivation
everything you've just said then we could talk for hours on, because it's something I've really thought about a lot myself, at different points in your career where everything's going through your mind and you're thinking about what can happen and what can't. Mm-hmm. And And probably just a couple of small things to take away from that, like maybe I've spoken about it before, only maybe with a couple of friends, or maybe I have, I don't know. But you know when Tom Pages stopped doing backflips? And I remembered that because I was still, I was just fresh to doing backflips and I hated it. And I remember talking to Sheenie and he's like, oh yeah, you'll hate that feeling for like the first year. And I was like, a year I've got to deal with this crap. Oh, you know, like every time you go to another compound and you got to flip again and that fear.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And then,
you know, what I've realized too, is that now that I've done thousands and thousands of flips, is that it's all your mind. You know what I mean? Because, and I only realized that recently is because I used to trip out on the flip a lot, and especially like after having a lot of downtime in my career, getting back on the bike and flipping again. But ultimately, if you understand the technique of doing the flip, you can do it off anything, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But even up to recently, I used to still trip out on it. But it's only because you get anxious and you start doing things out of sequence and you might pull a little bit early or you might pull a little bit late, and then that can result in an unsuccessful flip. Yeah. But if you just turn them – and the only reason you're pulling early and you're pulling late is because you're getting anxious, and you're only getting anxious because your mind's racing. So if you turn all that off and you just like go in the flow state and just let your body do – roll through the motions of what it's used to, and then it just happens easily. That's and then it. Usually like people can like – do it into a foam pit perfectly, but then go and like screw it up, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That was me. I did it perfect into foam and then I couldn't go to dirt. Then when I finally went to dirt, I only stayed on dirt. I didn't go back to foam. And then my last year in 2017, I had just that moment on the ramp where I don't know why my brain didn't want to do it. I've had a couple of floaters before when they happen. And this would have been a floater, but I just kind of front flipped over the ramp because I didn't go for the jump. I didn't peel off the side. I just kind of did nothing.
Mm.
And it was like 3 to 6 months. It took me to go there every day. I'd turn up and I shit myself. And it took me everything in 2 hours or 3 hours of being at the compound to do one flip. And as soon as I finally got it done, I'd go home and I'd had enough. And I thought, now I understand. Like, now I understand how Tom went through that part of his career and how it was so debilitating.
Actually, but he'd do like 360 flat spins and body variables.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, didn't make logical sense to me. But then I went through it and I'm like, okay, the mind is very powerful for good and for the negative.
Yeah,
and how you negotiate that part, but also just that part where you're saying before, you're gonna do it. You want to do these things despite the fear, and a lot of the other times I think about, you know, if you're talking to older people, 70, 80, 90 years old, they normally talk about the things they didn't do that they wished they did.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like it's cool to hear that. It's cool to hear that's where your mind is at and why you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah, if I do this, then I'm like, I kind of already realized like this is the one thing I want to do, that if I don't do it, I'll like just be so bitter for the rest of my life that I didn't do it. So I have to do it, and I owe it to myself and my wife and my kids to do it, because after I do it or if I don't do it, they have to live with me for the rest of my time, and they don't want an angry old.
I was going to say, you're just going to be this grumpy old guy until your last days, and everybody will be like, nah, we're not going to Maddo's house because he's just such a pain in the ass.
Yeah, yeah. I get that anyway right now, but no.
Okay, so that's not much different. Okay.
Yeah, it won't
be mate, so you will be better after it.
Yeah. But no, it's I'm excited for it. I wouldn't say selfish, but just personally, like, I feel like doing that, then after that I'll be able to speak a lot more truthfully and honestly, because it's something that I would have achieved. It's my lifelong dream. And then at some point in my life, I'd like to do motivational speaking, because I feel like it doesn't come out of me all the time, but like when I'm asked of it, I have like an ability that I can't just do like on demand. But if I'm asked of it, I can bring people up. I can inspire people. And
yeah,
I'd like to be able to get in a room of a bunch of people who want to hear from me and speak in a way that can improve their life. That'd be cool for me. That'd be rewarding for me to do that.
That's cool. And you're the right person to do it. Mate, I'm not going to hold you up because you did say you've got to go, and I know we're probably half an hour over here. So,
you're good, brother. It's been great to talk to you, man.
Thank you so much. Enjoy your time there in India. It's awesome to hear. It's awesome to hear what you're doing, but it's also really cool to see crews coming along and the family doing it all together. It's just cool to see you guys living life and having fun.
Thanks, bro. Yeah, we just made a vow to do this and do it with the kids and take them around as much as we can. And it's at first it seemed like a big challenge, but now we're in the midst of it. It's not so bad, and the kids are really enjoying it. We're going to keep doing it, you know, just try and keep these little guys inspired and happy and healthy and having fun. It's the main thing.
If you want to find out more about the Mad Will brand, I've left some links in the show notes and also how you can follow the young Cruz Madison on his adventures and, of course, the man himself, Maddo. And while he didn't reveal what his new plans really are, I'm actually blown away that there is something that still keeps this guy still motivated and wanting to reach even his biggest dream. And I have no idea if we're going to see that in 1 year, in 3 years, in 5 years, or what. But if he's at the point of at least making small talk about it in conversations on a podcast, and you can hear it in his voice, sounds like it's going to happen. So whatever it is, I'm wishing Maddo all the best in the preparation and making it happen. And for Cruz, all the best after making his debut into the world of freestyle motocross with that first show of his. And the future of seeing dumb things happen on two wheels, it's looking brighter and brighter. And I think we can all appreciate that. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to check out our Recast channel with the full video interview coming soon. I would have put it up earlier, but like I said, I'm off to hospital. And there's going to be plenty of the best bits in bite size across Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, and wherever else it all ends up. So it'll be coming in a few days. If you have any questions, though, on this episode or anything else in the world of freestyle motocross, maybe you've got your own suspicions on what Maddo's up to and you want to share your guesses, you can email me at steve@invertmanagement.com. or check out the website on riderslaungepodcast.com. Right, that's it from me. Up early tomorrow morning to get the old chop-chop done on my hip, and hopefully you'll hear from me again fairly soon after. I'll just be taking my time, having my Tannen Zapfler alcohol-free beer, cruising through the hospital, doing my rehab, and enjoying kind of like a holiday. So, yeah, I just hope they've got really good Wi-Fi in there as well. All right, guys, thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.